Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. If you go to MobiusStripPress.com, you can find out how you can download these podcasts and find our support documents and links. Well, before I get started in the Federalist Papers again, as I left off last week, let me start off with a very important critical date to the state of Washington, and that date is November 11th. Most people know November 11th as Veterans Day, but November 11th, 1889, Washington actually became a stakeholder in the Constitution, and that's when they became a part of the Union. So, in this effort of becoming a part of the stakeholder, we've actually got a national holiday that steps on top of that. And as a veteran, after serving 20 years, I think it's far more important that we recognize as a state the day we go into this constitutional contract and become a stakeholder of it than we partake in a national holiday. To me, Washington can find any other day in the year, there's plenty of them, to recognize veterans. And as a matter of fact, I would think that the Republic would be best if they started taking the day that they join the Union, each state, the day that each state joins the Union, I think it's paramount that they start recognizing their role as a stakeholder of the Constitution. And they should set aside that as a state holiday. That being said, if we do not make our focus on the compliance of the contract as each state and stakeholders of this contract, so I may be speaking a little in fragments here. I'll correct what I'm trying to say, or not correct, but clarify. Every state in this union has to make their focus compliance of the contract. And as we coalesce as states, we can easily do this. And so making the day that they join the union, each state, and for Washington, it's November 11th. So Washington should have an event on November 11th, recognizing its joining the Union and becoming a stakeholder of the Constitution. I know I'm repeating this, but it is paramount as the stakeholders that you recognize that anniversary of that very specific date. The reason we don't know or even recognize this is because most people just aren't attuned to the Constitution and the events that have occurred over time. But for the state of Washington, it's important that we start getting informed. It's important that we start getting involved. And we got to get involved at our local level and start vetting our representatives. They're the ones that are supposed to be defending us from federal tyranny. They're the ones that are supposed to be standing up and defending the Constitution and protecting the Constitution. Now, there are local organizations. There's official organizations and there's unofficial organizations. And I know two official organizations, one up in the Pacific Northwest, where there's the Thomas Jefferson Center, and there's one in Southern California that I've worked with. It's the Constitution Association. And each of these groups teach the Constitution. These groups do not teach case law and precedents. They don't go into that maze of lawyerdom and that mirage of constitutional law. The Constitution Association has hard classes that have been teaching the Constitution for a while, and as an organization, they acknowledge the constitutionality of my concept and principle of republic review. In working with the Thomas Jefferson Center, I see no indication that they too will not acknowledge this constitutionality of this principle, or my principle of republic review. There may be many organizations at a national level and local level, but a lot of these organizations do actually still cling on to these unconstitutional principles of case law and precedents. As I started off in this airing of this program, we are in this mess because of legal drift, that lawyers and the court system has been able to drift our Constitution in the direction that it does not allow. this is because there is an agenda. This is because there, and I don't use that C word, conspiracy, but there are people that are working, whether you want to call it collusion or what have you, that continually pushes us towards and away from individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and they're pushing us towards subjugation to the state, where the state will dictate everything. It's almost like Plato's Republic coming to life. Anyway, these organizations such as Hillsdale and these other local organizations and national organizations that cling to this unconstitutional concept of case law and precedents are really trying to create this whole mirage of what they call constitutional law. So why is this? So this is probably because there's this academic ivory tower that over the past century, and actually longer than that, since 1801 with John Marshall, has tried to create the self-aggrandizing of the legal system. That being said, whether they're noble or nefarious in trying to do what they think is good, the Constitution's a contract. It's not something that is being able to be pushed or thrown by the whims of the court or an oligarchy of robes. So anyway, I just want to make sure that everybody is attuned to the fact that November 11th is coming up, and I'm hoping to be working with an organization or two, if not all organizations, on the eastern side of Washington, where people can start figuring out how to recognize the importance of November 11th for the state of Washington as stakeholders. Now, where was I? Last week, I was talking about Federalist Paper number 85, which was dealing with an encroachment or the encroachments where Hamilton said that we have to rely on the states and the state legislatures to erect barriers against encroachments. I had several citations, and as a matter of fact, Madison and Hamilton both constantly argued the point that these encroachments could easily be dealt with by the states. Now, getting into the next Federalist paper, which is Federalist paper number 43, and I am jumping around a bit, but this is one where Madison starts talking about the Constitution as a contract. So let me quote this here. This is quoting Madison: "A compact between independent sovereigns founded on ordinary acts of legislative authority can pretend to no higher validity than a league or treaty between the parties. It is an established doctrine on the subject of treaties that all the articles are mutually conditions of each other, that a breach of any one article is a breach of the whole treaty." So I'm going to emphasize this. Going back, he's saying that these articles are mutually conditioned upon each other. I'm paraphrasing here. And that if any type of breach of one article or a portion of the article is a breach of the entire treaty. So going back to the quote, "and that a breach committed by either of the parties absolves the other and absolves them if they please to pronounce the compact violated and void." Now, let's look at this contract. Let's look at the Constitution. Which parties are there, or what are the parties involved? There are the 50 states who are the primary stakeholders. Primary. There's a secondary stakeholder that has been delegated very specific roles, responsibilities, and powers. That's the general government. The general government has an obligation to stay within the framework and the scope of the Constitution. And if they start going beyond that, and if you read again what I said last week on the Federalist Paper number 49, if you read and how we're supposed to deal with encroachments, we're actually supposed to appeal, or I should say the branches that are dealing with encroachments are supposed to appeal to the states to convene a convention for the enforcement and addressing these encroachments. That way we can ensure that the contract is being followed. So the states had this huge role in oversight over the federal government. The federal government wasn't given this ability for wiggle room. And really, if you think about it, how is it that the federal government was able to start wiggling, was able to start getting away from the contract? Well, they started using money and enticements of power and so forth. Either way, there's no allowance within the contract of statute of limitations. I've said this before, and if anybody can point to me where there's some statement in the ratification debates or anywhere where it says that if the federal government can get away with something for so long, then it becomes constitutional and it must be amended, and the federal government has the power to do that. You won't find that. You won't find any ability for drifting by court system. You won't find any ability for statute of limitations that, hey, if we're breaking the contract and you don't catch us and it's been 100 years, well, too bad. We get to continue to do this. A breach of the contract is a breach of the contract. And clearly that's exactly what Madison's saying here, that once you discover that this breach of contract is occurring, then you can literally start holding the government to that contract, and you can get into the process of doing that, and we will get into the process of doing that, but there are these hard limits that the contract possesses. So that being said, I'm about ready to start leading into our next Federalist paper, and that next Federalist paper, actually, I misspoke. It's not a Federalist paper. This is a statement from James Madison. And as I was saying, these hard limits in this contract, I also have a contract with my sponsors, so I'm coming up on a hard limit here. So let me take a second, and we'll go to this commercial break, and we'll be right back. All right. Well, I am very grateful and thankful for the support that I'm getting. And I'm definitely thankful for the input and feedback I'm getting. I'm in a few different exchanges with a few listeners. And so if you want to reach out, there's the Facebook Mobius Strip Press page on Facebook. Please make a comment there, or you can go to my website, mobiusstrippress.com, as I said earlier, and you can find my email on the author's page, and or on other pages such as the schedule page where the podcasts are. And you can forward me an email or just send me an email if you've got any questions or if you're looking for ways of support. I know I haven't put any mechanisms on the page yet for people to contribute or donate. I'm working through that because I'm doing all the work myself. Actually, I get a little bit of assistance from a few people, and I'm grateful for that too. However, let me get back to the meat and content, because that's why you're really listening. And the last Federalist Paper 43, where Madison was talking about the contract, Madison also talks during the Virginia ratifications about this contract. So I have a short paragraph or a paragraph that I'm going to read. But before I do, I want to make sure that people understand the ratification debates are actually hard appendages of the contract. And in contract law, if I write up a contract between you and I, and we both have this verbiage that basically seems to be a little ambiguous, and I say that this verbiage means exactly this, and I actually spell out the clarification of that, and you go, well, I see it as that way, and I go, yes, I agree with that. And so as we agree on what I proposed and then what you had said, that agreement on that language actually becomes a part of the contract. In contract negotiations, those types of things don't have to be hard amended. And technically, a verbal agreement is a contract in itself. And so when one is going through the process of ratifying, and when the states were in the process of ratifying the Constitution, as I said in my very first show, the people that were there that were explaining what this line meant, what that line meant, and speaking to the Constitution were the delegates that the state sent to the Constitutional Convention. These men had the insights and understood the arguments that occurred and understood the justification. So they were able to provide these clarifications and spell out what the Supremacy Clause really meant. So going into this one segment of the Virginia ratification debate, or this paragraph of James Madison. James Madison states, "Since the general civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of the freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachments of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. But on a candid examination of history, we shall find that turbulence, violence, and abuse of power by the majority, trampling on the rights of the minority, have produced factions and commotions which, in republics, have more frequently than any other cause produced despotism." If we go over, and this is Madison still speaking, if we go over the whole history of ancient and modern republics, we shall find their destruction to have generally resulted from these or those causes. And so the causes that he's talking about is when a majority is beginning to create a trampling on the rights of the minority. Are we at a point where the majority is ready to trample on the rights of the minority? Are there enough in the majority that hate Christians? Are there enough in the majority that want statism? The interesting thing is that it really doesn't matter about democracy, and it really doesn't matter about mob rule and majorities trampling on the rights of others. We have this contract called the Constitution that can't be weighed by a general opinion. It has to be ruled via the Article 5 process by 3/4 of the state. So what they did, and what Madison is explaining here, is even though republics can be destroyed in a democratic process, and he points out that republics and the despotism and tyranny really comes in a gradual process of the abuses of power through usurpations, more so than by violent and sudden usurpations. The point is that the Constitution has a mechanism that requires not just a mob rule, but it requires an insane rule. In other words, the 3/4 rule. You have to have 38 states all agree that this is the best thing for the republic. You can't just have 25 plus one, which would be 26 states that would dictate, well, we're going to force this on the majority. So the beautiful thing is that we have 13 states. We only need 13 states to maintain a sanity level in keeping the rest of the republic in check. And so when Madison here is talking about the contractual point, the fact of the matter is that the abridgments in the freedom of the people can't be occurring unless it's a violation of the contract. And so these gradual and silent encroachments that have been occurring over the past two centuries are actually feeding and leading us into this majority of entitlement. And as they've continually been able to boil the frog, they've been able to set us up to where a majority is rising up out of our education system because people do not understand the dangers that we're dealing with at this time, of how we can easily throw away the Constitution and allow ourselves to be subjugated by a global governance, UN, or some other mechanism of government. And so as long as the states are clinging to the Constitution as parties and stakeholders and saying, we're not going to allow the federal government or any entity to come and take away our Constitution and how we're functioning. And, oh, by the way, we now need to get the federal government back into the compliance of this. And the only mechanism that we have, again, and going back to our Federalist Paper number 49, is the administrative process of convening a convention and dealing with these encroachments. These encroachments, you know, whether you think it's welfare, whether you think it's immigration as your primary focus, those are just the symptoms again, folks. The real problem is compliance to the contract. They're so out of compliance that they're spending us into ruin. And so we have the ability with Republic Review of pulling this back and being able to get them back, or being able to get the federal government, being them, back into the framework and the context of the Constitution and functioning within the scope of that Constitution. another contractual point during the ratification debates that Madison argued, and it basically echoes what he said in the Federalist Papers, but I quote, "The powers of the federal government are enumerated," which means that they're fast, they're not ambiguous, they can do this, they can do this, they can do this, and that's all. And so going back to what he says, the power of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. In other words, if there's no amendment to the Constitution to give the government the ability to maintain highways, waterways, and so forth, then the government is unconstitutionally ruling, or I should say, has created an unconstitutional role, responsibility, and power that we would call the Department of Transportation. It's the same thing with the Department of Health. Where's the amendment for that? Where's the amendment for the Department of Justice? As a matter of fact, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions were dealing with the first time the federal government tried to create a new law and basically prosecute and punish violators of the law, when the Constitution really only granted the power of prosecuting people for treason. That was really the only law that they could go after people for. And so we'll get into those resolutions a little bit later. The next bullet point that I want to go through, or contractual point number three, and this is, again, from the Virginia resolutions, and this is James Madison, and he says that this assembly views the powers of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are parties as limited by the plain sense and intention of the instrument constituting the compact, as no further valid that they are authorized by the grants enumerated in the compact, and that in case of a deliberate, palpable, or blatant and dangerous exercise of these powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within the respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. So he is reemphasizing what he said in the Federalist Papers, and he's telling the delegates of the Virginia ratification committee or convention that we can only do what the federal government, or what the Constitution has given us to do as far as the federal government, and that the states have the right and are duty bound to interpose for arresting this progress of evil. I'm running out of time here, folks, but I've got another show coming up and we'll get into this more. I hope you go to my site, MobiusStripPress.com, and pull in this PDF and start reading these and start finding these in context to the Federalist Papers and the ratification debates. Until next week, God bless, and please hit me up on Facebook. Talk to you later. Bye now.